Last night at the Sanger Theater, I went and saw one of the new touring Broadway musicals. It's called Hell's Kitchen. And I go to see all the Broadway shows there. My fiance and I, Julia, really get a kick out of doing that. We have a little sort of tradition. We go get a drink. We go see the play. We have a great time. Hell's Kitchen knocked my socks off, man. You've got to go see Hell's Kitchen. I can't recommend it strongly enough. I understand there's probably some people listening who are like, I don't care about Broadway. I don't go to the theater. And that's fine. We're all here to do what we're all here to do. If I can convince you otherwise, great. But I'm speaking now to people who would enjoy taking their wife or husband or mother or kids or friend, business associate, whatever, out for a night on the town. Visit the beautiful, historic Sanger Theater on Canal Street and go see Hell's Kitchen. And I say this with a little bit of authority because, like I said, I've seen just about every single touring Broadway show that's been here in the last couple of years. And Hell's Kitchen knocks them all out of the water. Hamilton, nothing. Got nothing on Hell's Kitchen. I won't say a ton about it, but Hell's Kitchen is what they call a jukebox musical. It's a musical where some or all of the songs are from pop music. It's music that we know. This musical is built with songs written by Alicia Keys. And I don't know, Alicia Keys has been in and out of our lives for like the last 25 years. I don't particularly care about Alicia Keys. I've never considered myself a big Alicia Keys fan. I've never bought her music. I would probably not leap to attend an Alicia Keys concert. But this musical is incredible. It's captivating. It's got great energy. It's that the choreography is fantastic. The singing is fantastic. It's a visual feast. It's got beautiful costumes and set pieces. And it's a very, very touching story. You know, it's called Hell's Kitchen because of the neighborhood in New York City. I think it's sort of an Alicia Keys autobiography, right? So it's about a young woman growing up in New York City. She's trying to find her way. She learns how to play the piano. She's got a love life that's complicated. She's got a family, a home situation that's a little bit busted. And on paper, I don't know, that didn't look that interesting to me. But the execution of this show was so good that the entire audience unhesitatingly leapt to its feet for a rousing standing ovation. I mean, the curtain is barely even up. The performers aren't even on stage for curtain call before everyone's going nuts for Hell's Kitchen. Young, old, black, white, regular theater people, non-regular theater people, moved mountains this show. I can't say enough about it, but I strongly encourage you to go see Hell's Kitchen. It's playing at the Sanger, opened last night. They got performances all the way through Sunday. Go see Hell's Kitchen at the Sanger Theater. I did. And I'm so glad that I did. We have a great show today. There's a lot to talk about. We're going to see what we can squeeze in here. It is, of course, New Year's Eve. Happy New Year's to you. The price of silver has exploded thanks to demand from artificial intelligence and some other new technologies. But, you know, that's not great news for everybody. For silver investors and people who are looking to sell their silver, yeah, great. The price has exploded. You get more money for your silver. But there could be some problems to this. There could be some reasons that we shouldn't be too enthusiastic about this. China's making a major move here. I believe this major move goes into effect tonight at midnight. And this is going to probably send prices even higher and maybe like forever. Hard to see silver prices coming down in a meaningful way after China does this thing at midnight. There are some industrialists out there, some people who are experts in the field of commodity trading and financial markets, who are looking at this with a great deal of concern. And so what we're going to do is we're going to speak to the professor of finance and the director of the Global Energy Management Institute at the University of Houston. His name is Craig Perrong, and he's going to be on with us in just about 10 minutes here. At 2:10, we're going to talk to Debbie Bressler. You remember Debbie. She's from the Crescent City Countdown Club. We're going to get the details from her on the NOLA New Year's Eve fireworks show that's happening tonight. We'll figure out what's planned, what's new this year, and, you know, just talk about the best way to ring in the new year in New Orleans. I've always been enthusiastic about going to see the fireworks show at midnight on New Year's, and I can't wait to talk to Debbie about that. Maybe dole out some pro tips for some of you who are maybe less familiar with how to get around the French Quarter when there's, you know, an extra 50,000 people down there, whatever. I can tell you all about it. In the 3 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to a man named Robert Lawless, and we're going to talk to him about a particular federal agency whose sole mission is the only mission is to protect you and I and other working class Americans from bank fraud, from hidden fees, predatory lending, predatory debt collection. You know, when you get a surprise fee on your credit card, that's like, oh, you didn't use your credit card in this correct way, or you were a day late on your payment, and now you owe us all this extra money. Stuff like that. There is a federal agency whose entire mission is to stand up for you and I against those big, you know, multi-billion dollar international companies who love to just chuck extra fees at you and screw you over, knowing that you may not have the time or the resources, the bandwidth to fight back. And the easier thing to do is just kind of roll over and pay the fee and try and get on with your life. Naturally, in our time, in our age here, this federal agency is on the brink of collapse. It's actually facing an existential crisis. We're talking, of course, about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It hasn't been around for terribly long, but notably, it turns a profit. Not every federal agency returns more money to the tax coffers than it takes out, right? But because the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau recoups some of this money from credit card companies and mortgage lenders and stuff like that, and then they turn around and they give that money back into the general fund. And that money gets spent on highways and airports and road improvements and, you know, whatever else we want to spend federal tax money on. Robert Lawless is a professor of law, and he's the co-director of the Illinois Program on Law, Behavior, and Social Science at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And he'll be on with us at 3:25 again to talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and why it's on the eve of total collapse. Yesterday on the show, we spoke a little bit about the fraud cases in Minnesota. We spoke a little bit about the strikes in Venezuela. Maybe it was Venezuela. We don't know. It could have been somewhere else. It could have not happened at all. We talked about the strikes in Nigeria. We can revisit some of that today. Some of those stories are still ongoing. And I did want to follow up on something I mentioned yesterday. You know, I made this 22-hour long drive down from Providence, Rhode Island to New Orleans over the weekend because a couple of my flights got canceled and I didn't want to keep playing the flight cancellation roulette game. So my fiance and I just rented a car and hauled ass down here. And we went to not one, not two, but three Buc-ee's on the way back and had ample opportunity to try some of the hot food, try some of the different flavor of jerky, try some of the beaver nugs. And so I thought maybe we could play a sort of little game today, gamify it a little bit. And let's see if we can rank some of the food at Buc-ee's. Like if you had only just 10 seconds to run into a Buc-ee's and then run back out, you know, what would you grab? If price is no object, but you got 10 seconds just to sprint into a Buc-ee's and sprint back out to the car, what are you picking up? I didn't plan this, but it so happens that Coleman's in the jar and he's wearing a Buc-ee's beanie. What Buc-ee's did you get that beanie from?
I did not get this at any Buc-ee's because I've never been to a Buc-ee's.
Was that a gift?
That was a gift from Scoop.
Yes. Oh, that's right. I remember you because he loves to go to Buc-ee's.
Yeah.
That guy drives out to the Buc-ee's in Mississippi just like for something to do on a Thursday night. And he comes back and he brings us treats. He always brings me the drizzled popcorn.
I've had the drizzled popcorn.
And he brought you a Buc-ee's beanie.
Yeah. I've also had some friends that bought me some ghost pepper beef jerky.
Yeah.
And the scorpion sauce. Now, right there on your phone, this is another coincidence.
What is this?
That's a list of my top 50 most attractive women. What? I want you to zoom in and read number two.
Alicia Keys
is my second most attractive woman on the planet, in my opinion. So when you was talking about that and you was talking about Hell's Kitchen, I immediately thought it was a Matt Murdock play. I was like, oh, I would love to go see Matt Murdock in Hell's Kitchen if that's Daredevil for those who aren't.
No, initially. No, yeah, yeah.
All right, so, but when you said it was about Alicia Keys, I was like, Ah,
you should go check it out. Maybe.
See what, yeah. If well, it's kind of loosely based on her.
I wish I'd known. I might have been able to get you a ticket to go see it with us last night. But I think you'd enjoy it. I mean, it's like I said, it's semi autobiographical, mm-hmm. so it's like loosely based on Alicia Keys' life. It's not as opposed to like the Neil Diamond musical, right. which I saw last month, which is like the Neil Diamond story. The main character is Neil Diamond. But man, I walked out of that theater feeling great because I've seen a bunch of those plays. Like I saw Back to the Future, which was, the important thing is those performers are getting okay. work.
So you know what I'm saying? Do you think the fact that you went there with tempered expectations that kind of heightened the wow, because it kind of yeah. caught you by surprise?
Yeah.
Right, that's fair to say. That's not to take away from
like
it.
I said, on paper, I'm like, okay, a coming of age story about a young woman in New York City who learns how to play the piano. I'm like, okay. You know, I'm not going to fall over myself to spend money to go see that. But, you know, I go see these musicals and I try to keep an open mind about it. Some of them are better than others. That's inevitable. But this one just came out of nowhere, man. Just out of left field, off the top rope. Just it was my favorite thing that I've seen in years. Like I said, better than Hamilton, better than Les Miserables or some of the other like sort of big Les Miserables.
Yeah.
The other musicals that we might be familiar with. But this just came out on Broadway 2 years ago and it's touring and it's incredible.
Okay. Well, I say all that to say this. I think the ghost pepper beef jerk is my favorite Buc-ee's food, even though I've never been to a Buc-ee's.
Well, next time I go, I'll bring you back some cinnamon beaver nugs. We'll step away here and we're going to come back with Craig Perrong. The way to get in touch with me today is the Oakenheart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. That number is 504-260-1870. I will read 100% of the text messages you send me today. I will reply to as many as I can, and the very best ones I will read on the air, so make them count. I'm Ian Hoke City, and for Scoot, he'll be back on Monday. I'll be back right after this. Stick around. While I was on holiday, I was up in Concord, New Hampshire with my fiance for Christmas. And over the weekend, then I got a text from a friend of mine, longtime friend of mine, a guy I met in college, somebody I really respect, really intelligent guy, smart guy. He reads a lot. He knows a lot about a lot of different kinds of things. But he texts me and see what he sent me. And sometimes this guy will text me stuff like, you know, the moon landing wasn't real or the moon is hollow. That's where I got that story idea, if you remember that. But he texts in, he says, he texted me on my phone. He says, you got to go buy some silver, man. Get your hands on some silver. Get all the physical silver you can. Do it this weekend. You'll be sad if you didn't. Love you, bro. So, you know, I looked into it a little bit. And yeah, I'm not a commodities guy. I don't own any precious metals. But silver prices have gone through the roof, driven by AI and their use in solar panels and some other high-tech manufacturing applications. And so now China is making moves that could tighten the global supply and drive the price even higher. So why should I care? Why are normal people suddenly talking about silver like it's toilet paper at the beginning of the pandemic, you know? I've invited Craig Perrong onto the show today to help us make some sense of this. He is a professor of finance and director of the Global Energy Management Institute at the University of Houston. Professor, welcome to the show and thanks for making time.
Thank you for having me.
Honestly, are you also getting texts from friends asking you about silver and telling you to go buy silver before it's too late?
No, I haven't gotten any texts from friends about that. You know, they know I follow things by myself, and so they don't need to prompt me to pay attention to these things.
I guess I should be thankful that I have friends that know that I don't have a I don't have a lot of money to throw around, and maybe they want to help me get some silver. All right, so explain to us what's happening here, Professor. The price of silver looks like it's just about tripled since earlier this year. How do you explain that? How does that happen? Why aren't other commodities doing that at the same time?
Well, it's important to bring up other commodities. One thing that's been remarkable about the past year is that oil prices have been relatively weak, but metals overall and precious metals in particular have been strong. And so throughout the year, gold has risen, platinum has risen, palladium has risen, copper has risen. The real sort of break between silver, platinum, copper, and palladium and gold is basically, going back to late November, right around Thanksgiving. And one way that people look at this is the gold-silver ratio. And, the gold-silver ratio was relatively flat through most of the year, meaning that gold and silver were tending to rise pretty much together.
Right.
But at the end of November, basically, then silver spiked up relative to gold. And like I said, these other commodities did as well. The fact that these other metal commodities are going up at the same time suggests that, there's maybe some fundamental factors, because these are all metals that are used in, as you noted in your introduction, in a variety of industrial kinds of applications. And you have sort of two stories going on here. One is the sort of the general rise in metals through the year, and then the breakout of these other metals, including silver, later in the year. And it could be sort of speculative driven, but the fact that it's happening among a variety of commodities suggests that there's something fundamental going on.
It sounds a bit to me like this is just me, but I never really thought about silver as being one of these metals that we talk about in the conversation where we talk about like rare earth metals. Like, I think we all understand these minerals that are, we don't really think about them, but they are absolutely essential in the manufacture of batteries and solar panels and stuff like that. So I also remember, too, before the big, chip shortage, we didn't really ever have to think about semiconductors. But now suddenly, securing the semiconductor supply chain is like priority one for the Biden administration. Is it safe to say that silver has now kind of moved into that territory where it's not just, something that we think about like a pirate chest or coins, right, or our grandparents' dishware? Like, now it's actually something that we really have to think hard about, not only as a government, as regulators, but as individuals.
Yeah, and you bring out an important point, is that silver sort of has sort of a dual identity, or a couple things driving it. So it is sort of a store of value. People have it as coins or as an investment, things of that nature. But it also does have widespread industrial applications, and this has been true. I mean, if you want to go back, I'm old, and so I remember back in the Hunt silver thing, back in 1979, 1980. There was also then a relatively large commercial demand for silver, but that was mainly from photography. Now it's from other uses. And that's where you have this interplay in silver, which is kind of interesting, between sort of speculative store of value kinds of considerations on the one hand and industrial applications on the other. And so that's what makes it somewhat unusual as a commodity and different as a commodity. That's why I think it's sometimes its behavior is a little bit harder to understand because of the interplay between these two very different drivers. Mm.
Really interesting. Okay, great. I think I'm understanding more about this now. If we can move, Professor, to talk more about what China is doing. They're going to be tightening control over their exports. To me, as a layperson, that sounds kind of ominous. That sounds like bad news for everybody who needs silver, not just to make, artificial intelligence centers and solar panels, but everything else. What is China doing, and why is it a problem for the rest of the world?
Well, So you also brought up another good point earlier about, rare earths, and sort of China had, has a stranglehold on rare earths, and it's tightened and loosened that stranglehold, recently. But as it loosened up on rare earths, it seems to have tightened up on silver. Now, it doesn't have the same stranglehold over the silver market as it does over, rare earths. But it is a major player, and the prospect of reduced exports from China, is contributing to this. Although the price run up, we really knew that China was going to do this towards the end of October, and that was about a month before this spike that I alluded to earlier. Mm-hmm. China's there's definitely something about that, and I think it's a lot of it is just Chinese policy frequently can be quite difficult to understand exactly what they're doing, what is really going to be the impact of this new licensing regime, how tightly are they going to enforce it. And so that's a source of uncertainty that I think is driving some of this latest run-up.
So there really is no consensus or maybe even no way to even really meaningfully know or say if this is a long-term strategy or if China is just trying to gain some short-term leverage here. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. And, this is part of a larger game between the United States and the Trump administration and China. This has a tit for tat aspect to it. China says, oh, we're going to ease off on rare earths, but, we're going to tighten up on silver. And, it's taking place in the context of this much bigger game between China and the U.S. And knowing how that game is going to play out and how the Chinese are playing it is very difficult to know from the outside.
I'm curious too, just to hang on to China for one more moment. They have the kind of, is it true to say they have the lion's share of rare earth metals that are still under the ground?
Well, so that's not so much under the ground. Where China's advantage is in the processing. So basically processing of rare earth metals is very highly polluting. It's basically our environmental restrictions in the United States and other Western countries have basically made it prohibitively costly to process rare earths here. As opposed to China, which is evidently willing to live with the environmental consequences.
Yeah.
And so rare earths really aren't that rare, but it's the processing the processing sector is dominated by China, and that's what gives them the leverage here.
So it's not that they just won the geological lottery and had all the silver and all the lithium, underneath Chinese soil. It's that the Chinese Communist Party is willing to process this material in a way that might be, harmful to the environment, harmful to their citizens, in a way that the rest of the world, especially in the West, are not. And that's why they seem to continually have the advantage when we have these conversations.
Absolutely. And the only thing that I would change in what you just said is might. They've definitely been willing to accept. They've definitely been willing to accept environmental consequences that the United States and other countries outside of China have not been willing to accept.
Great, great, great. I'm learning so much. I love this. OK, so back here in the States, if silver stays this expensive, and again, for the reasons we have just gone through, there's no guarantee that it will. Right. Before I move on. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay, great. So if silver stays expensive, where does that show up in my life, in my producer's life, in the life of people listening? Do our phones cost more? Does, Grok, Gemini, these products only start costing more because the server farms cost more to construct? What happens to us if silver stays this expensive? How do we feel that?
Well, so silver is important, but a relatively small component of the overall cost and the kinds of things that you've seen. So the people that are actually buying the silver to use in their various industrial applications, that will basically, be a hit on their profits, but it's going to be hard for you and I and your listeners to really see anything demonstrable about that. It's like different than, if OPEC, cuts production and you see that the price of the gasoline at the pump goes up by a buck. It's, there's so many, other components that are used and other processes that are used in conjunction with silver that you're not really going to see the silver price per se come through to you, except maybe when you go to the jewelry store.
Right. Okay. Well, good. I'm glad you mentioned that because the friend of mine who texted me last week and kind of got me on this whole train of thought in the first place, he had explained that he went to Causeway Coin here in New Orleans and bought some silver there like 5 days ago. And even just in that 5 days, the price of the silver, the value of the silver that he purchased is up like 20 or 30% or something. So for people who are listening today and thinking, oh, man, maybe I should actually do something. What is the calm, rational response? How do we keep, people acting responsibly in a situation like this? I mean, not just you and I having this conversation on the radio, but you know, is there a risk of like a silver panic? Are we going to see people rushing out and spending their life savings on silver only to see the price collapse in February?
Well, I would recommend that, you know, individual investors and individual savers, you know, not jump on this bandwagon, because that usually does not end well. And, you know, again, sort of harking back to history, if you look at the, you know, sort of the Hunt Silver episode, you know, there was something called Silver Thursday where the price crashed on one day because of regulatory intervention. And then, you know, within a few weeks, you know, the price of silver was, you know, 20% of what it had been at the peak. And so just as things can rocket up, they can also fall pretty quickly. And yeah, that's not unusual in commodity markets. So, I would not rush in to follow this trend, because that trend can turn pretty quickly.
Excellent. Okay, Professor, I have just a couple minutes left. I do want to get to some of these questions I'm getting on my text line from the listening audience.
Sure.
Rusty is listening today, and he says, ask the professor if he thinks it has to do with half of the world wanting to go back to the gold standard and or stable coins and the new digital currency. The U.S. wants to implement to basically get rid of the debt and stay in control. So is it other countries that buying all these metals, or people in our country that's purchasing all these metals?
Well, it's a worldwide phenomenon, and you know, in fact, if you look at the London silver price, that's actually gone up more than the price in the United States, and it's higher than the price in the United States right now. Whereas usually the situation was the reverse. So there is, you know, that's sort of the macro angle of things, is that, you know, one thing that precious metals do is that their price goes up as the value of fiat currency goes down. They're basically mirror images of one another. So if you were thinking about a return to the gold standard, though, that would explain, you know, the gold price rising, but it would not explain this recent rise in silver relative to gold. So I think that there's something to that, but it's not. I don't think it's the main explanation for the run up in silver, particularly.
I think in response to my question about, you know, what does this mean for normal people? Here's a text that says, "What do you honestly believe is going to happen? Anything that requires silver to be part of the manufacturing of an item is going to go up." Is it that simple, Professor? Like if I make an iPhone and it has a certain amount of silver in it, and suddenly that silver costs me $100 more to acquire, do I turn around and then ask the customer for $100 more, or is it a little more nuanced than that?
Well, it's a little bit more nuanced. And the first thing is that, you know, yeah, even though silver is an important part of many things, it's, you know, not a dominant cost driver for most things. And so that's, you know, that's why a rise in the price of silver can get sort of lost in the other noise. The other thing is that whenever you have a price of something like silver that's an input to other things like phones, like you said, it basically, the price of the consumer goes up, but also the margin that the producer receives goes down. So basically, you know, in this case, you know, Apple will, you know, its profits will be a little bit lower. The prices that you pay will be a little bit higher.
Well, I think we all learned a lot here, Professor. I thank you for your time, your work, and your weight. But before we let you go, I'm just curious, in your line of work at the University of Houston, if you had to look into your crystal ball into 2026, what do you think's kind of the top storyline? What's the thing that you're talking about at cocktail parties and around the dinner table with your friends in regard to, you know, what you know about finance and commodities and what the economies in these big countries are going to look like next year?
Well, yeah, I think that the big issue is sort of the macro picture. I mean, when the Trump tariffs went into effect, there are all these predictions of doom and gloom for 2025. That have not been realized, and the U.S. economy in particular has been relatively strong in the past 6 months. And so the main issue to me is whether that's going to continue or not.
Interesting. Very good. Craig Perong, thank you so much. He's a professor of finance and director of the Global Energy Management Institute at the University of Houston. We hope you have a very happy new year, and we can't wait to talk to you again, sir. Thank you so much.
Right. Likewise. Thank you.
All right. When we come back, I'll get to more of your text messages and ask you, you know, about some of the experiences you might have had in the past where you're encouraged to get in on a trend, what is the hot new thing to buy, or a meme stock, something that you panic bought? I'm curious to talk to you about some of that, because I think I've done some of that in the past, but nothing that's really worked out terribly poorly for me. So we can talk about some of that coming up next. The way to get in touch is the Oak and Hart Jewelers talking text line, 504-260-1870. BRB. Quick, look out the window. Look at this big, beautiful sky. What a day. I didn't quite plan the show this way today, that we'd be talking about high finance all day. We're talking about commodities markets, and we're talking about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in the 3 o'clock hour. But at 2 o'clock, just about 20 minutes, we'll be talking to Debbie Bressler, and we'll talk a little bit about what's happening tonight with the New Year's celebrations along the riverfront. This is a project that WWL and our sister station Magic 101.9 are very happy to be a part of every year. Debbie does an incredible job pulling this all together. A lot of community partners have to get involved to make something like this happen. And it really is, I mean, I'm not just blowing smoke. Like, this is really regarded as one of the best fireworks shows in the country. So if you have never seen it, maybe this is your year. I don't know if you have New Year's plans or not already in place, but I would encourage you to come down here tonight. You know, get a nice meal if you can. Maybe you'll meet some Georgia Bulldogs fan, or maybe you'll meet some Ole Miss Rebels people, because brothers and sisters, they are out there. If you're in town from Oxford or from Georgia, thank you for being here with us. Be safe tonight. You know, somebody texted in earlier and says, is it possible to set up a shop and sell fireworks in Orleans Parish? And it is not. That's, I think, why there's the big fireworks outlet, like right on the other side of the Twins fans when you get to Slidell. Because everybody from New Orleans wants to buy fireworks and shoot them off in town, which, you know, not for nothing, you're also not allowed to do, but people tend to ignore that. But it got me wondering, you know, maybe you have a tip that you want to share if you're a person that has pets that freak out when there's fireworks going off all over the neighborhood. You have a dog or a cat or a snake or a handful of mice. I don't know. Whatever your pet is, if they freak out when there's fireworks, you know, what do you do? Is there something you offer them? Like, you give them a gummy or a thunder jacket, or you just hide with them under the bed? I don't know. I mean, don't give your dog a gummy unless it's a special gummy for dogs. Wow, I'm kind of out over my skis here, aren't I? Well, you think that's funny?
No.
Don't give gummies to dogs.
I'm not going to win any favors here from anybody, but I hope my neighbor's dogs do freak out because of the fire.
What? Why?
Every morning when I come to work, there's some presents left in my lawn. I don't know if my neighbor's aware of what his Dachshunds are doing, but it's like, dude, I'm not doing that, clearly. Yeah, he has like two little weenie dogs.
That's especially obnoxious.
Yeah,
that's worse than if it was a different breed of dog.
Yeah, and I don't think he walks the dogs. He just lets them out. So I don't think he realizes that some of his dogs are leaving presents in my lawn.
I see.
So I might have to go tell him. But hopefully for the New Year's, maybe the fireworks will freak him out and scare him.
Maybe they'll stay inside.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll leave some presents in their kitchen under their dining room table, you know.
Right.
Just for a change. Anyway, there's a big concert tonight happening at Waldenburg Park. It starts at 9 o'clock. It's got a bunch of great local bands in it. You know some of these people. Dumpsta Funk, Sweet Crude, DJ Captain Charles. That all leads up to the Midnight Flirtily Drop and that big fireworks show that happens at midnight. I don't know if you ever watched the fireworks at Crescent Park, which is, you know, there's Waldenburg Park kind of in front of the aquarium, and then there's the Moonwalk, you know, in front of Jackson Square, and then new, like in the last 10, 12 years, is Crescent Park, which we've talked about on this program a bunch. It's usually closed around 7 o'clock, 7:30, something like that. But on the 4th of July and on New Year's Eve, it makes great, great fireworks viewing. I'm thinking about people especially who grew up in New Orleans and were here, you know, in some of these downtown neighborhoods, maybe in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And you move to the suburbs, or you move to the North Shore, and you haven't come back down here and seen what this part of the riverfront looks like, because it was never available for public access until quite recently, which means you get a view of the city skyline that most people never really get a chance to see. You know, like if you take the ferry across the river to Algiers, or you live on the West Bank, you know, you get to see the city skyline every day, okay? But there's a certain angle of, you know, the downtown area, the cathedral, the skyscrapers, the bridge, that kind of nobody got to see unless you were a riverboat captain or, you know, you worked on the docks or something or on the wharves. But now you can see it. And the fireworks show there looks incredible. I've seen it many times. Strongly recommend that you go down there and check that out. Let's jump over here to the Oakland Art Jewelers talking text line. Looks like Coach Edwa is here today. I think that's Edwa. Says, stay safe tonight, everyone. Along with the fireworks, some idiots fire guns into the sky, and a bullet can travel 10 or more miles before plummeting downward. I hope it doesn't need saying, but don't shoot your guns into the sky, man. We're not doing that. Maybe there was a time when we did that routinely. I was not around for that, but I really hope nobody is firing weapons into the sky tonight. That is a terrible, terrible idea. James on the North Shore says, it's lovely out here today. I'm working on the flower beds in Mandeville. Thank you, James. Soothsayer Sam says, in skydiving circles, we call this severe clear. LOL. Yeah, it is beautiful. You really cannot see a cloud in the sky out here. It's gorgeous. All right, Coleman, let's take a break here, and we'll come back, get a couple more texts in here before we do the news, and then we'll talk to Debbie Ressler at 2:10. After that, we'll do the news bomb, and then I don't have another scheduled interview until 3:25, so it's just you and me. We can kind of talk about whatever you want. It's effectively a holiday. The office building is closed. The Odyssey offices are closed. Just me and Coleman and Chris Miller, so let's hang out. I'm Ian Hoke sitting in for Scoot. I'll be right back after this. I'm made to understand that last week on the Scoot Show, while I was in New Hampshire, we did not talk about Lane Kiffin and his trip to the grocery store.
I can say I don't recall.
Where he came back with the grocery basket. All right, we'll find a little bit of time in the next hour to talk about that. I still want to talk about, if you have just 10 seconds to run into a Buc-ee's and come out with one thing to eat, where price is no object, you just got to go in, you get a sandwich, or you get some nugs, or you get some jerky, or you get some of the like frosted cashews, whatever they got in there. What are you taking? If you got 10 seconds to run into a Buc-ee's, grab one thing of food and run back out, what is it? Text me right now, 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Art Jewelers talking text line, 504-260-1870. What's one thing that you would go take from a Buc-ee's if you only had 10 seconds? We'll come back after the news with Debbie Bressler and more of your answers about Buc-ee's. I'm Ian Hoken for Scoot. Stick around. You're listening to WWL. Oh, okay. Oh, my. We know this guy. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. All right. I love it. Join us online right now is Debbie Bressler from the Crescent City Countdown Club. Debbie, thank you so much for joining us today. How's it going?
Thank you for having me. It's going really well. Everything's ready to go. So
I know you've been
filling up and it's exciting.
I know you've been crazy busy doing this sort of thing. How many years have you been doing this?
About 31 or 32 years,
holy,
I think, I'm afraid to say, and working with you guys. I mean, it's because of WWL Magic. It's given us an international reach for people to celebrate the new year in New Orleans. So, this has been all of us together.
I was just telling people last hour, you know, this is a big pull. Logistics, mm-hmm. Expenses, mm-hmm. A lot of community partners involved in this. And Debbie Bressler is the center of the wheel. So we are so grateful for your work and thankful to be a part of this.
Well, thank you so much. It truly is a community project. And as you know, every year we start from $0 in order to put it on. And there have been times we've come pretty close to not having the sponsors. And
that's right.
We're so, so fortunate that, people come back and we keep it's the backdrop for all the activities in New Orleans. How could you have New Year's Eve and not have fireworks?
Yeah, you're right. I've been talking about it all week here, Debbie, so I think people kind of have the main details in place. But, if you're in an elevator with somebody for 30 seconds and you want to tell them about what's happening tonight, what's your pitch?
Just come see the magic on the Mississippi. Go to CrescentCityCountdown.org for all the information. I think the parade is starting now. And then you've got the music with French Quarter Festivals from 9 to 12 if the fleur-de-lis drops. And here comes the fireworks at midnight. Happy 2026.
I'm so glad that the fleur-de-lis drop is happening. That's one of my favorite things. I realize now that there's a part of my brain that I think is kind of, I'm not sure if this happened. I might have just totally made this up. So hopefully you can straight. You've been doing this for 31 years, so you should be the authority here, I would guess, not me. Did it used to be a pot of gumbo? Did there used to be a gumbo pot drop?
Yes, it was a year of Katrina, and we came back. Brian Kern, who's president of the Crescent City Countdown Club, you know, New Orleans has just had the hurricane, and the media from all over the world was here. He got a gumbo pot to drop. We used to, I think it was just a little ball or something we had before on top of Jackson condominiums. And we did the gumbo pot, and then the next year we made our own fleur-de-lis, which is what we've dropped. But the gumbo pot kind of wobbled, but we knew we had to do something because it was the first time we gave signal to the world that we're not underwater, we're here, and that New Orleans was open for business. And people were, I mean, media was just everywhere. It was amazing. But yes, that gumbo pot waddled
okay.
down.
Okay, so it was just 1 year, and it was after Katrina, which explains why my memory of it's a little bit fuzzy. Because
yes,
that's
it was a gumbo pot.
And I won't go on and on about it, because it's not what this time is set aside for. But that year, I was trying so hard, and this is my senior year of college, right? And I've just moved back to New Orleans. I had to move to Chicago for a couple months after Katrina. I come back in January. I'm living in Broadmoor. I got no running water. I got no power.
Oh,
my
gosh.
Roommate and I, you know, we're studying by candlelight. We're taking showers at the gym, at school. You know, it was a crazy
great
time.
Memories.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. It was, and you know, we're 20, 21 years old, so quite resilient. You know, we didn't really mind the cold and you know, eating ramen noodles and stuff. But we tried so hard to get down to Jackson Square for the fireworks, and we were too late. And it's like 11:59:30, and we're still 4 or 5 blocks away from Jackson Square. And we say, you know, we're not going to make it. So we just ducked into a bar on Charter Street. And we were just like, well, I guess let's just go to a bar. And the bar that we ducked into was called Evelyn's Place. And now it's the Backspace Bar. And there's very few people in there. But this a woman named Evelyn, for whom the bar was named, and we just kind of walked in there and were her only customers at that precise moment, because everybody was out at the gumbo pot drop. And we had a little champagne toast in there, just my roommate and myself and a friend of ours and Miss Evelyn. And that was just a precious little thing. And we continued to go see Miss Evelyn for New Year's Eve until her passing. And then the bar became something else later. But so that's what I was doing New Year's Eve 2006. So no wonder I missed the gumbo pot drop. But it wasn't actually a pot of gumbo, right?
No, it was manufactured by, you know, Blaine Curran.
Okay, it was a light up pot of gumbo.
And Brian went and said, what can we have that we can drop? I mean, listen, we had barricades down there that they had put down that we were wiping off. It was just locals. There were not a lot of tourists at that first one. And I mean, it was just amazing. Just like the Mardi Gras, everybody was like holding hands all the way down St. Charles Avenue, and it was quiet. But we're resilient. This is what we do. We live in a city that can, I mean, we have a heart and a soul, and we show it everywhere we can. So, you know, it's great.
Spectacular.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, you talk about the beginning and all of that. It's because of that we ended up incorporating into a nonprofit so that we could be able to not pull resources from the community that needed to be there. And we continue to do that. So Crescent City Countdown Club produces the show in partnership with New Orleans Tourism and Cultural Foundation, Allstate Sugar Bowl, the Berger and Tiller Families, French Quarter Festivals, Inc., who also do the New Orleans Eve concert at Woldenburg, and Pyromania Fireworks, the new fireworks company, and, of course, Magic, WWL. Could not do it without you and about 15 other community sponsors. We're just so grateful, and we want everybody to get out and have a wonderful evening and celebrate New Orleans style.
I'll leave it at that, Debbie. I don't know. There's no better way to put it than that. That, you know, the parade is happening now. The concert starts at 9 o'clock, then the fleur-de-lis drop and the fireworks at midnight. And it's just it's a spectacular show. It's a great show of, you know, community teamwork. And we're also grateful to you and everybody else that you just mentioned in helping us pull this off. Thank you. And Happy New Year.
Same to you, and thank you. And of course, we remember our sweet friend Helen. So.
Of course. There's not a day that goes by. You know, I work in Helen's old office, so I think about Helen Santani every day.
All the pixie dust and all the Disney stuff is gone.
I kept some of the Disney stuff. It is still in there. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I have to tell you, somebody left a rock at my front door. I love Winnie the Pooh, and I took it and put it at her gravesite a couple weeks ago.
Debbie,
I left it there. She loves Disney.
That is so sweet. That is so sweet of you to do that. Thank you, ma'am. Mm-hmm. We're so grateful.
Absolutely. Have a happy, healthy, fun new year.
Yes, ma'am. You do the same. We'll talk to you before the 4th of July.
Sounds good. Thank you.
There goes
you.
Debbie Bressler with the Crescent City Countdown Club. Thank you so much. When we come back, we'll do the news bomb. We'll get the latest out of Minnesota. And a little bit later, we'll learn what's happening with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Lots more to cover today. Would love for you to get out tonight and go check out the fireworks show. Let's go to break with let's go to break with Will Smith. Crank it up. Remember this one?
Is it too late to say this slaps?
No.
Get it? This slaps. Chris Rock.
90. Now it's 99. 10 years behind me. Who the hell cares? Don't stop the beat. Oh, yeah. Excuse me. Millennium. Hold up. It is. I had kind of forgotten that I picked out that stupid Will Smith song. But here's the Counting Crows. This is a little more somber. Check it out. Always happy to be on the air with you around December 30th, December 31st. We have an opportunity to play that song. We're going to play another very, really a beautiful, perfect New Year's Eve song coming up, going not into the next break, but the break after that. The song is called The Parting Glass, and it's a traditional Irish song that actually is the song that we used to sing on New Year's Eve before we started singing Auld Lang Syne. So we'll hear The Parting Glass going into the break in about 15 or 20 minutes here. So don't miss that. It's a special moment. But first, please, Coleman, light it up. We got another news bomb for you. We'll take care of some business here, and then we'll get back to the fun stuff on our way into the evening. Listen, if you depend on Social Security to pay rent or pay for medicine or make groceries, you might want to start thinking of ways you're going to get creative about saving next year, because the Social Security Agency is going to start 2026 in pretty bad shape.
Internal administration documents reviewed by the Washington Post show the agency's shrinking workforce has struggled to respond to 6 million pending cases in its processing centers and 12 million transactions in its field offices. The Trump administration fired 7,000 employees earlier this year. The Post says inexperienced staff have been left to handle the aftermath, delaying basic services to millions of Social Security recipients.
That is bad news. But the more important thing to understand here is that this is not just Social Security collapsing on its own. It's the opposite. It's actually being actively, quietly pulled apart. Staffing cuts, like the man said, 7,000 jobs, office closures. There's a Social Security office in the building, three stores below me, and there was a non-zero chance that that office closed. It's still open, thank God, but all the people that are coming in and out of here all day to deal with their Social Security issues might have had to go somewhere else. Lots of other people all across the country have not had the privilege of their Social Security office remaining open. So this means longer waits. It means unanswered phones, unanswered questions, people being pushed into online systems, websites, apps that don't work very well for seniors sometimes or disabled people. Now, the checks are still going out, thank God, but everything around that is fraying, and it's not an accident. Social Security is very popular, it's very efficient, and it is paid for by us, which makes it politically dangerous to attack head on. So instead of attacking it head on, they have to just make it miserable for us to deal with. I'll give you an example. My fiance, Julia, calls this weaponized incompetence. Again, this is just an example, but if Julia asks me to load the dishwasher and I purposefully load the dishwasher like an idiot with the glasses and the mugs facing up and the plates stacked horizontally on top of one another, and instead of detergent, I put blue plate mayonnaise in the soap dispenser, maybe she won't ask me to load the dishwasher again. weaponized incompetence. That's what's happening here. That's what Republicans have been doing to Social Security and other agencies for my entire lifetime. They let service degrade. They let frustration mount. Then they point to the mess and they say, see, the government can't handle this. We should privatize it. That is not failure. That is a deliberate management strategy. And Trump and Elon Musk and the doggy boys found a way to take it to the next level. And the consequences are serious. This isn't just about convenience. This is about working people's rent money. This is about seniors' medication, disability income, survivor benefits. When the customer service system breaks, it's not just an annoyance. It's a serious problem for Social Security recipients. They fall behind. They panic. They add pressure on their loved ones. They get hurt. Maybe they lose their home. Social Security did not suddenly break on its own. The point of these cuts that the Trump administration and DOGE made is to run Social Security in a way that makes it look broken. You run it badly, you make everyone there miserable, and then you pretend that their misery is evidence that it doesn't deserve to exist in the first place. And this is, historically speaking, the most reliable program in the federal government. And if they cannot even answer the phone, that is not mismanagement. That is someone standing there saying, see, I told you I couldn't load the dishwasher. One of the finest performing arts centers in the country is suddenly radioactive to performing artists, and everyone knows why.
The board of Washington, D.C.'s Kennedy Center voted less than 2 weeks ago to rename it, and workers added Trump's name the very next day. Not long after came the cancellations, a Christmas Eve jazz concert, and now a jazz New Year's Eve featuring the supergroup The Cookers. They didn't mention the renaming, but emphasized their commitment to music that bridges divisions. Separately, sax player Billy Harper says he would never even consider performing in a venue bearing a name that he says represents overt racism and deliberate destruction of African American music and culture. Kennedy Center President Richard Grinnell tells AP the last-minute cancellations show those artists were always unwilling to perform for everyone. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Richard Grinnell should take every seat and shut the hell up. Of all the stupid things happening in American politics right now, and the field is extremely competitive, this might be the stupidest. His argument, and the argument from the White House, is that renaming the Kennedy Center after Trump somehow depoliticized it. And the artists who are walking away are just radicals, which only works if you pretend that politics entered this situation when the musicians left, not when the board, at Trump's request, slapped his name on the building. May I remind you that the Kennedy Center is literally JFK's memorial? The same way that we have the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial. This is the Kennedy Memorial, the Kennedy Center. So if you think that it's okay for Donald Trump to stick his name on someone else's memorial, I'm sure that you're going to take it sitting down when the city renames Jackson Square to Latoya Cantrell Andrew Jackson Square. It's the same thing. It's so unbelievably stupid. And to be clear about something else, these people that are not showing up for these gigs, these people that are canceling, that is not some radical political act. That is the most basic freedom that they have. No one is owed anyone else's labor. They didn't just shut the place down. They're not throwing eggs at the wall. They just said, nah, I don't want to do this gig. And they took their work somewhere else. That is not activism. That is a business decision for them. Healthy cultural institutions do not need threats to keep artists on stage and wanting to perform there and booking concerts. You cannot save the Kennedy Center from some nebulous threat by watching the schedule empty out and the subscriber base collapse. The gaslighting is just off the chain with these people. And all of this is just to soothe the ego of the biggest malignant narcissist to ever sit in the Oval Office. What a clown show this is, my God. Every day is a new adventure for the Department of Justice, being run by a bunch of people that you'd expect to hear spent their life savings talking to a 1-800 psychic that they saw on television at 2 in the morning.
A newly unsealed order in the criminal case against Kilmar Abrego Garcia reveals that high-level Justice Department officials pushed for his indictment, calling it a top priority only after he was mistakenly deported and then ordered returned to the U.S. Abrego Garcia is seeking to have the case dismissed on the grounds that the prosecution is vindictive, a way for President Trump's administration to punish him for the embarrassment of his mistaken deportation. He's pleaded not guilty in federal court in Tennessee to charges of human smuggling. I'm Marcela Sanchez.
So, yeah, listen, this is the part where I try not to say, "I told you so," but the court documents are being extremely rude about that. I told you so. This newly unsealed order shows that the Department of Justice only decided Kilmar Abrego Garcia was a top priority after they accidentally deported him and after he won that court battle. The alleged crime that they charged him with was almost 3 years old. It sat there, did nothing. No one cared. It's collecting dust. And then suddenly, boom, it's urgent. The minute the administration looks like they don't know what they're doing, spoiler alert, they don't. And again, I don't love doing this. I'm trying to say this gently because it's on the record. I wrote about this back on April 16th of this year on this station's website on WWL.com. I wrote a blog post called "The Conservative Case for Bringing Kilmar Abrego Garcia Back to the U.S. It is still published there. You can still go find it. And I predicted this in that blog post. I literally said that the Department of Justice's next move would be trying to justify deporting him after the fact instead of just admitting that they did that and then bringing him home. And I predicted that not because I'm clairvoyant, like I'm a precog or I got a magical crystal ball, but because I understand that this is how the president, the president's companies, the president's administration, the president's family do things. When someone shows you who they are, believe them. They have been doing this for 10 years. You don't undo your mistake. You don't admit that you screwed up. You just decide that the person you hurt must have deserved it somehow. Retroactive criminalization. Very efficient. Very American, apparently. Finally, out in Minnesota, the administration says that all this is about protecting children from fraud. But the record on who Trump wants to see punished for fraud is worth revisiting.
In an online post, the CDC's acting director, Jim O'Neill, states blatant fraud appears to be rampant in Minnesota, and the Trump administration has now frozen child care funds to the state. The move follows years of investigation that began with a $300 million scheme at the nonprofit Feeding Our Future, for which 57 defendants have been convicted. Prosecutors said the organization was at the center of the country's largest COVID-19-related fraud scam, in which defendants exploited a state-run, federally funded program intended to provide food for children. Earlier this month, the federal prosecutor alleged half or more of the roughly $18 billion in federal funds that supported 14 programs in Minnesota may have been stolen. I'm Ben Thomas.
Yeah, so we talked about this yesterday. I won't go on too long about it, but we need a quick reset here. Yeah, the fraud in Minnesota is real. There have been real fraud cases, big ones. People have already gone to prison for them. More people will go to prison, and I'm glad about that. I'm glad this is all coming to light. There's no argument from there. But what I'm not glad about is this move today where HHS, the Trump administration, says they're freezing child care money for 19,000 kids based on a viral video. And then they're just promising to figure it out later. It's too difficult for them to go after specific fraudsters, so they just shut off all the money. the same way it's too difficult to decide which January 6 rioters was just a little grandma who got lost in the Capitol building and which one went in there with a gun trying to kill Nancy Pelosi. So just pardon them all. It's just too much work. Yeah, just pardon them all. It's the same thing. So they just shut off all the funding to the entire state of Minnesota, and the families be damned. They can eat the consequences. The White House says it's suddenly very serious about fraud because Tim Walz was mean to them last year. But if the fraudster, the person committing the fraud, is politically useful, hey, it's pardon season. Let's talk about some fraud cases that ended in convictions for people that Trump then offered a full pardon to. Here's a reminder of people that have already been pardoned by Trump for either being charged with or convicted of fraud. Steve Bannon, we know that guy. You may recall he was charged with defrauding people who sent money into the company called We Build the Wall. When it became apparent we were not going to build the wall, Steve Bannon and a couple of his buddies got together and said, well, give us your money and we'll make sure the wall gets built. That was fraud. That operation raised about $25 million from public donors. They did not do anything with that. Charged with fraud, Trump pardoned him before the case even went to trial. Bernard Kerik, you might remember that guy, pled guilty to tax fraud and lying to investigators while he was serving as New York City's police commissioner, crimes involving about $1 million. Trump gave him a full pardon. Charles Kushner, tax evasion, illegal campaign contributions totaling $1.2 million, full pardon. Paul Manafort, tax fraud, financial crimes involving tens of millions of dollars, including unpaid taxes owed to the United States government. Trump gave him a full pardon. There are many, many more of these. These are just the names that we would recognize. Fraud is bad. People who do fraud should go to jail. But this is not a moral crusade against fraud. This is the weaponization of government, of the system of justice. When fraud involves politically connected people and millions of dollars, they get pardoned, the crime gets erased. When fraud happens and it is a convenient excuse, it embarrasses Democrats, it embarrasses black people, then they freeze childcare money for toddlers and they call that accountability. The Trump administration does not oppose fraud. They oppose unauthorized fraud. So maybe Donald Trump will pardon the woman who spearheaded the entire fraud scheme in Minnesota and is already in prison. Maybe he'll pardon her. After all, she's white. That does it for the News Bomb today. If you want to react to anything you just heard, I got plenty of time to talk to you. The way to do it is the Oakland Art Jewelers Talking Text Line, 504-260-1870. At 325, we'll talk more about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Until then, I'm not locked in here with you. You're locked in here with me. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting for Scoot on WWL. Be right back. In the next hour, we'll talk just a little bit more about Buc-ee's and a little bit about Lane Kiffin and his adventure at the grocery store. I don't know if you heard anything about that, but it's pretty funny. And I think it makes him a little bit more human and warms me up to him a little bit. We'll also get to some of your calls, Gregory and Paul and the rest of you. If you're on hold, stay there. I'll talk to you as quickly as I can after the news. After we get our first look at afternoon traffic at 325, we're going to talk to Robert Lawless about what's happening at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and why you should give a damn. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting in for Scoot. We'll be back right after this. Don't touch that dial. In the next hour, we'll talk just a little bit more about Buc-ee's and a little bit about Lane Kiffin and his adventure at the grocery store. I don't know if you heard anything about that, but it's pretty funny. And I think it makes him a little bit more human and warms me up to him a little bit. We'll also get to some of your calls, Gregory and Paul and the rest of you. If you're on hold, stay there. I'll talk to you as quickly as I can after the news. After we get our first look at afternoon traffic at 3:25, we're going to talk to Robert Lawless about what's happening at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and why you should give a damn. I'm Ian Hoke sitting in for Scoot. We'll be back right after this. Don't touch that dial. For the low, low price of $91 million, Louisiana State University has secured Lane Kiffin as the head football coach. He has taken reins officially. There's a story at WWL.com about that very specific thing. But Lane Kiffin made news last week. This cracks me up. It really does. Lane Kiffin made news last week because his daughter, whose name is Landry, posted a video on TikTok that shows her father, Lane Kiffin, Coach Kiffin, coming back home from the grocery store carrying a black hand basket, like the kind that you get when you walk into the grocery store. Not the push cart, not the buggy, but like the hand basket with the two little handles that flip up, and it's full of groceries. And his daughter, his daughter Landry, asks him, "Dad, what are you doing with that basket?" And he turns around, he looks at the camera, says, "What? They make you pay for the bags." So he just took the basket with him. And so this has been kind of divisive on the internet. People are like, "Man, this guy's pretty wealthy. What's he doing not being willing to pay for these grocery bags?" Which, I don't know, I didn't get that sense of it. And then, you know, Lane Kiffin himself posted on social media. He's like, "Hey, this is not a big deal. Like, I took the basket back to the store. I'm not some totally entitled centimillionaire who thinks he shouldn't have to pay 10 cents for a plastic bag. I think he just didn't want to pay for the bag." And he's like, why would I do that when I can just take the basket home, empty the groceries into my refrigerator, and then take the basket back to the store?"
So wait, did he take it back to the store?
He says he took it back to the store. I can't independently corroborate that. I'm just some guy on the radio. But if he says he took it back to the store, that's good enough for me. And I'm thinking, like, I don't know, I'm sure the grocery stores don't want you doing that because they would probably lose a lot of those baskets. But that's a pretty easy way to cut down on, like, plastic bag waste. If that's the thing you care about, which I'm, you know.
I believe he's going to have lane privileges, meaning that they will let him get away with it because it's Lane. But also that might start a trend called laning, where people just take baskets home and bring it back.
Yeah.
My whole thing is, why would Landry put it on TikTok? Why would you do that?
I think, he later told ESPN, he was like, Landry was not supposed to post that. She said she wasn't going to put that video up. So I think Landry was probably got a little stern talking to at home. He's like, I'm not just the dog catcher here. You know, no disrespect to dog catcher, but I got kind of high profile job. I got to keep a lot of different people happy. I got to be respectable in the eyes of my employees and the guys who play for the Tigers. You can't go posting that. But,
So, spitballing here, how much do you think the groceries cost if he was able to carry it in one little bag?
It looks like a bottle of bleach. I think I see a dozen eggs, something green, maybe looks like a dark leafy green, maybe spinach or kale. Something else in maybe a liter. It might be a Coke bottle or soda water or something. I don't know.
So in this economy, around $90?
Yeah, it's probably, $90 to $100 just for the bleach. No, I mean, realistically, this can't be more than $50 worth of stuff.
I've never been in one of those grocery stores eggs. Where they make you pay for a bag. How much is it usually?
It's usually 10 cents a bag.
I can swing that.
You can swing that, certainly. I mean, you'd spend 10 cents on stupider stuff than that. I mean, look, I can see, if you're buying groceries for the whole month and you got 50 bags, like, okay, that's $5 that you probably would have liked to keep. But for Lane Kiffin, I mean, he's talking about, 20, 30 cents here. But let him take the basket.
I can't see the basket from here, the one that he took, but I'm quite sure it's sturdier than the bag that was going to sell him for 10 cents.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe, if he kept the basket, he could use it again for something. I saw something, I won't go on and on about this because I want to get to these calls, but keep a laundry basket in your car and put your groceries, don't bag them at all. Like, go through the checkout, just put all the groceries right back in your basket, just the way that you put them in when you got them off the shelves. And then when you get out to the car, take them all out of the buggy and put them in the laundry basket in your car, return the buggy, and then when it's time to go in, you just take the whole laundry basket out of the trunk and bring it inside.
That sounds like a good idea, but my neighbors are nosy and they might see I have like a cup of sugar. He just got some sugar and they're going to come over and like, I just saw you brought sugar inside because I can see through the holes in the basket. Can I borrow some sugar?
I don't think they're going to come for your sugar. They're going to come for your Jägermeister, Coleman.
Nobody wants the Jägermeister.
They're going to go party with Coleman. Let's get some calls in here, guys. Thanks for your patience. We'll start in Michigan. Paul, you're on the air. Good afternoon.
Ian, Happy New Year. I wasn't expecting to get home ec advice
from you. And to you as well. What's going on today, man?
I appreciate it. All right. If your inner circle cannot convince him that you can't reduce the prices by 600%, it makes us the laughing stock of the world.
Yeah.
And say what you want about Biden, but at least the people that he had surrounding him were more of an expert on their duties.
I think you hit the nail on the head here, Paul. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you won't catch me defending Biden. You know, the whole dementia thing is falling asleep. He's losing track of where he is and waving at people off camera. That was a learning moment for all of us. But it is inevitable. You cannot argue that he was surrounded by competent public officials. And the rest of the world saw it that way. And that's not the situation that we're in right now.
Unfortunate.
Well, the world will just keep turning. 2026 will be full of adventures, won't it, Paul?
I just hope the pendulum swings fast. So,
yeah,
we'll see. Good luck to all of us.
Yeah, indeed. All right, be good, Paul. Happy New Year. Let's go to Gregory in Metairie. Gregory, go ahead, brother. Welcome back.
And nice to talk to you again. Happy New Year, of course. Stuart must be in Portland, huh?
I'm not sure where he is. I haven't spoken to him since Christmas. I don't know if he skipped town or not.
I didn't want to pry. Hey, this guy, I wanted to talk about something else, but this new coach for LSU.
Yeah.
Guy Brousson, I inadvertently walked out one of those black little carry baskets, and then I remember what I did, and I just, I ran back. But, I was just in a hurry,
Sure.
And I had quite a few items. But your thing about the laundry basket, I'm going to do that.
Hey, I'm not just some dumbass with the microphone. I got some good ideas over here, Gregory.
Yeah, that's why I call you. That's why I admire you. We don't agree on a lot of stuff, but I do love you, brother.
I love you back, man. Go ahead.
On your first hour, you were talking about Causeway Coin and about what Silver's going through. And I really like that guy because I had known that Silver was going to go through the roof a long time ago. About 3, maybe 4 years ago, we had to clear out my family's home. My father passed away, and then almost a year to the date, mine was gone too. And part of my settlement, my parents were very generous. I didn't know how wealthy that my great-grandfather and my grandfather were. There was all this silver. I do remember it as a child, at Thanksgiving and Christmas time. I got over 250 pounds of sterling silver in candelabras, silverware, flat. Oh, yeah.
Brother.
It's all mine. And I went to Causeway Coin. The guy was so nice. He says, listen, Mr. Brown, this stuff is very valuable. You'd be better on the auction market. I mean, I'll give you the money it's worth in silver weight. And that was several years ago. What, maybe a year and a half ago?
Uh-huh.
And he gave me good advice. Said, hold on to it. Bring it to an auction. Go to an auction site. You're going to get, I'm talking about candelabras, trophies that my great-grandfather won.
Wow.
Yachting on Lake Pontchartrain. I'm not kidding you. From 1880. And I had always seen those trophies growing up. Yeah, and then trophies for golf, too. Oh, golly. And that was my grandfather himself in the 1920s. So I got silver going back from 1880 up into the 40s. And not to mention all the little knickknacks, goblets. I mean, I'm talking about tour. I got boxes and boxes of this stuff. My brother didn't want it. He said, I don't have any need for that. And I said, I guess I'll take it. Blah, blah, blah. It's still wrapped in Excelsior and stuff like that. But I showed a few pieces to the guys at Causeway Coin, and he's like, I'd be glad to buy it for you, but all I'm going to do is melt it down.
Yeah, I would be curious to know, like, what the melt value would be versus what like a collector would want for the silver.
It's just over $80 an ounce now. It's just over $80 an ounce.
I just looked it up, Gregory, and I don't know if you're sitting down or not, but 250 pounds of silver is worth about $263,000 today.
I knew it.
So I'm glad for you, man. You know, send us a fruit basket in the next year, Gregory. Have a happy new year, man. I got to move on here. Thanks for listening. Let's go to Jack in River Ridge. Jack, you're on the air.
Ian, happy new year.
And to you as well, brother. What's on your mind today, Jack?
Well, I just want to comment on some of the things you've been talking about, you know, about Trump. Look, I just want to challenge people for the new year to stop approaching this as though you were rooting for your team, you know, like the Saints against the Falcons. And look, it's stop just watching whatever guy that you follow on social media, you know, whether it's Hannity or whoever you Newsmax. Because, look, I have relatives, too. They sit down there, they watch Newsmax, they watch Fox, and whatever comes out of their mouths, they believe it. They never question it. You simply have to know at this point that he's lying to you. And honestly, that's not his fault. That if you're still supporting Trump at this point, that's your fault, okay? Because he couldn't make it more obvious than he does.
And, he's not really trying hard to keep it up a secret anymore, is he?
No, he's not. And look, I'm gonna let you go because I realize you want to end the year on an uptick. But look, did you happen to see the Wicked? You know, the last installment.
The what?
Wicked.
Wicked. The set. What is it? For Good? No, I haven't seen that yet. I was supposed to see it a couple weeks ago, and something got screwed up. What's that about?
Okay, well, there's a scene in the movie that will remind you of Trump. At least it reminded me of Trump.
Okay.
The wicked witch is.
Oh, no spoilers now. Wait,
no spoilers now, Jack.
Wait, hold on.
Look, this isn't going to spoil anything. But she's threatening the wizard, you know, Jeff Goldblum, that she's going to prove to the people that he has no real power.
Yeah.
Okay. And Jeff Goldblum looks at her and says, "Would you been running a scam as long as I have? There comes a point where the truth just doesn't matter. And until these people start to feel a little more pain, unfortunately, I think that's what it's going to take before they wake up."
Yeah. Yeah, man. Jack, thank you so much for that commentary, man. Thank you, and Happy New Year to you. I did want to say one more thing before we step away real quick, and Jack kind of touched on this. And I said this to somebody that I met when I was in Concord last week at a party, and I was telling them about what I do and why I think it's important. And I told to them, like, you know, I get on the air and I say what I think is true, and I try to be humble about it. And I try to invite people into a conversation not based on, are you a Trump supporter or not? Are you a liberal or are you a conservative? Are you a Democrat or are you Republican? Where I try to meet people is, do you want to live in fantasy or reality? Because that tends to get a cleaner result. Like, there is no sort of instant recognition of partisanship there. It's not about ideology. It's simply, do you want to live in a place of truth or do you want to live in a place of fantasy? And if that's how we begin these conversations, I think we'll get farther both with each other in these conversations, in these debates, and as a country. Because I have never met anyone that said I would prefer to stay in the Matrix. You know what I mean? We'll get a look at traffic with Ian Ozan. Hey, that's different. And when we come back, we'll be talking to a man named Robert Lawless. He's going to talk to us about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is in pretty bad shape heading into 2026. It is one of the few federal agencies that actually turns a profit and returns money to the United States taxpayers. So why is the Trump administration trying to destroy it? We'll talk about that and much more after this. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting in for Scoot. He'll be back on Monday. I'll be back right after this. Stick around. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Maybe you've never heard of it before. That's okay. This agency's entire job is to stop banks and credit card companies and payday lenders and debt collectors from screwing over people like you and me. And it has been hanging on by a thread for months. The White House has been trying to shut it down without Congress's approval. One of the main architects of Project 2025 is the acting director of the agency. We are going to get some detail from this with Professor Robert Lawless, who's a professor of law and co-director of the Illinois Program on Law, Behavior, and Social Science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Professor, welcome to the show. Thanks for making time today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Now, I want to come out right away and say that I think I have muddied the water here before our conversation even starts, because I used a kind of shorthand to tease this conversation. And I said that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau makes a profit, which, of course, in the most literal sense of the word profit, is impossible. That's not what happens. What I meant to say, and didn't, and I apologize, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau returns more money to American consumers than it costs to run the agency. To your knowledge, is that a fairer way to say that?
That is absolutely accurate and completely
okay,
fair.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so much. I did want to be accurate about that. Okay. I wonder, Professor, if for people who have no idea, explain to us what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau does and why it's been such a target for this administration.
Well, I think your introduction did very well with that. It's there to make sure that lenders, all sorts of financial services providers to everyday people play by the rules and offer products that are fair. You know, a lot of people take out loans for lots of good reasons. The lenders that make those loans deserve to earn a fair profit, but a profit that's fair and not one that comes from nickel and diming people or, you know, with gotcha tricks and all sorts of all sorts of things that range for everything from just the slick sales pitches to outright fraud. And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was put there by Congress to kind of be the cop on the beat to make sure that stuff doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. So the argument here that the White House is making, and I'm going to talk slowly for myself because this stuff is kind of complicated. The White House is arguing that this agency should not get funding because the Fed is technically operating at a loss. Can you explain that argument? I don't even understand, like, technically or legally what that means.
Okay, hopefully we're all sitting down for this, because you're right. It gets very complicated. So the idea, when Congress created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it tried to insulate it from everyday politics. And one of the things it did is it decoupled the funding from the usual way that agencies get funded, right? And usually the way agencies get funded is we all pay taxes, and some of those taxes go to pay the agency's expenses. What Congress did is they had the funding come from the Federal Reserve and the earnings of the Federal Reserve.
Whoa.
So actually, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau doesn't cost taxpayers any money.
Wow.
So the funding comes from the Federal Reserve. And since it was created and started in 2011 until recently, everybody understood that what would happen would be that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and this is specified in the law, would ask the Federal Reserve for its annual funding, and the Federal Reserve would transfer the funds to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Now, I'm glossing over a lot of specifics. There are caps and things that limits on what the CFPB can ask for, but generally speaking, that's what would happen. And the word that the law uses is earnings of the Federal Reserve. And just in the last few months, the Trump administration has argued that earnings means profits. And the Federal Reserve does not have is not earning a profit, at least since 2022. Up until 2022, every year the Federal Reserve took in more than that went out its door.
Uh-huh.
But beginning in 2022, as interest rates were going up and the Federal Reserve was paying more interest expenses, there's an argument that more was going out than coming in. There are arguments going the other way. So the argument of the Trump administration and Mr. Vought is that because in beginning in 2022 and 2023, 24, 25, the Federal Reserve had more going out than coming in, there are no earnings
right
of the Federal Reserve. So that's in a nutshell the legal question as to what the statute means by the word earnings.
Wow. Okay, everyone hand your papers to the front of the class and we'll see you in homeroom. This is really interesting. Thank you for breaking that down in a way that we can understand.
I hope I did. It's as you said, it's very complicated, but that's at its most basic level kind of the unfortunately you have to get into what the law itself actually uses and the word it uses is earnings, right? And so maybe another way to say this is, you know, you think about your local restaurant, right? It's got people it has to pay, your servers, the food and all like that. Are its earnings what it has left over or what everyone pays as they come in for their meals? That's the question. The Trump administration has taken one position on that. The district court in the District of Columbia has said, no, earnings, it means whatever comes in the front door. It's not net of expenses. And so that's where we're at the moment.
Okay. Yeah, that good. That brings us right to the right place I want to go next. So this week, this federal judge stepped in and says, you guys can't shut down this agency just by starving it to death and laying everybody off. This is an agency that exists because Congress created it. You cannot just unilaterally kill it by lack of funding or any other means. You must fund this agency. Do you think that court order will stick? And what happens if it doesn't?
This is even get more complicated.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right. So, your pens and pencils.
It's hard to say whether it will stick or not. I think this case is already in the appellate court. So the case itself actually comes from the union that represents employees at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And they filed this lawsuit back in the fall. I forget exactly when, saying exactly what you're saying. The administration cannot unilaterally shut down a agency that was created by Congress. Mm-hmm. The district court issued an injunction and said, that's absolutely right. You cannot take any steps to end this agency. And so the court is going to issues that injunction. And while it continues to hear the case, that all part of the case all gets appealed. That injunction is more or less still in place. The Trump administration's position is we're obeying the injunction. We're not taking any steps to prevent the agency or shut down the agency, but we've now decided and discovered that we can't get any funding for the agency for all the reasons we just talked about. So what happened just yesterday was the court ruled that not asking for funding is within the court's previous order saying don't take any steps to shut down the agency. By not asking for funding, you are effectively shutting down the agency.
Right.
If that makes all makes sense.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. It doesn't not make sense, but I'm just kind of trying to absorb it all and think, because we have such limited time left, and I want to make sure people kind of walk away from this conversation with something. You know, it's a holiday tomorrow, and I want to think, what are people going to remember about this conversation on Friday? So,
you ask, is it going to continue, right? So
yeah.
I think it's pretty clear that when Congress enacts an agency, the executive branch by itself can't just shut it down. I think it's very hard to argue to the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening in this case and other cases is the procedural wranglings in the court is allowing the administration to effectively do the same thing. So even if, as this case proceeds, when you get to the end, And the court says, no, you can't do any of the, can have done any of this. If all the employees are gone, if the agency has basically kind of ceased to function,
frozen. Yeah.
The administration is going to accomplish what it wanted to accomplish as a practical matter.
And what is the consequence for our listeners? What is the consequence from the consumers if the bureau has been kind of frozen, inactive in the sort of zombie state for the better part of a year already? If that continues, what does that mean for us?
Well, it's going to mean that there's more opportunities, frankly, for people to be cheated by financial institutions. There's one less cop on the beat. There's still state attorneys general, but they're busy. They have other missions, and they can only do so much. The innovation of the CFPB was to put some resources at the federal level, and also to have a flexible agency that could adapt as the times change. Right, technology is changing the lending industry and the consumer financial industry tremendously. The CFPB had statutory tools to address that. Without the CFPB, that's all going away. So just at the end of the day, there's just going to be more opportunities for people to be cheated.
With my last moment here, Professor, I'm not going to ask you to get political, like left or right or conservative or Republican, but just from a political science standpoint, where is there a sort of toehold for anybody to argue against the existence of this agency other than bad actors? Like who could possibly object to these sort of regulations being in place except for people who want to screw us out of our money?
Well, it also, there was a lot that the CFPB did that was good for the industry. It provided certainty and safe harbors and things that and enabled the industry, the good actors in the industry, to offer good products. I think that the argument against the agency, and it's not really an argument against the agency, but there were, as often happens in regulated industries, there were arguments about overreach.
Sure.
There were arguments that the CFPB had the power to go in and do what are called supervisory visits and look at books and records and try to prevent violations before they happened. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, if you're a business that has that happening to you, that's burdensome and costly. And that's where a lot of the objections were. I think those are way overblown. There was lots of examples of that supervisory process. You know, it's a conversation between the business and the agency, and a lot of examples of those supervisory visits producing good results that were good for consumers, I think good for the business. But that's where I think the hostility is coming from, and it probably comes also from just a general kind of philosophical anti-regulatory standpoint.
Okay. Well, we certainly understand that. So it's not no mystery there. We have to stop here, Professor, but this is a difficult thing to understand, but I think I understand it better, and I'm sure my listeners do too. Thank you so much for your time, your work, and your way. We'll reach back out again when this pops up in the news again next year.
No problem. I hope I've helped.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Robert Lawless is a professor in law and co-director of the Illinois Program on Law, Behavior, and Social Science at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. If you want to react to anything you just heard, the way to get in touch is, of course, the Okunart Jewelers Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. I'm Ian Hoke. We'll be right back after this. Stick around. Okay, all the difficult stuff is out of the way. We're not talking about politics anymore. We're not talking about finance. We're talking about what's going to happen tonight. It's New Year's Eve. I hope you have a great time. Our listener, Steve, is texting in. He says, Coleman and Ian, if you go out tonight to ring in the new year, be aware of your surroundings, stay in a group, have fun, be safe. Happy New Year. Don't do anything you don't want your mother to know about. That's good advice. I love that part with the guitar where it goes, blit, blit, you know what I'm saying?
The plinkies?
The blit, blit.
It reminds me of that thing on The Price is Right that goes, the blink, 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 blink.
Oh, they're like Plinko?
Yeah.
The little plinkies.
Yeah, that's what it does. Blink, 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 blink.
I love this song, man. I wish I was around in the disco era. Because they got, like, what's it called? damn it, I'm not going to remember the name. Oh, Solid Gold. Solid Gold is, they go around to nightclubs around town and they play like disco songs all night. So you get to dance to this music, but man, it's just not the same. You know, people, I the bell bottoms and the suits and the platform shoes and the Quaaludes and whatever else they had going on back then.
Yeah, I don't think I can enjoy that. I need to stay somewhere past 82.
Oh, yeah?
I don't want to go anywhere past 68.
Here's a text that says, me and my wife, we give our dogs calming chews to help them deal with the fireworks. And I ask them what brand they say. It's called Thunder Ease from PetSmart. So if you have dogs that are going to flip their lid tonight, you may enjoy stopping by a PetSmart or a Petco, whatever you guys got around here. I go to the Petco in Carrollton. They know me in there. And pick up some Thunderies, except those dogs. Except Coleman's neighbor's dogs. They shouldn't get Thunderies. They should freak out because you don't like those dogs.
Right, but then I thought about it. I think freaking out might make them, you know, leave
more
surprises.
That's what I was saying. It's like, yeah, they might evacuate on your neighbor's kitchen floor, which maybe will help your neighbor realize, you know, the error of their ways.
Real quickly, what are you running into Buc-ee's with? Did we get your answer?
Oh, what did I get out of? Oh, like what? Okay,
yeah.
I run into Buc-ee's. I got 10 seconds to run into Buc-ee's and come right back out. Club Melt.
Club Melt. All right.
And now I think some people might think, oh, the Club Melt is like not that good. But it's the last thing that I had there was the Club Melt. And it really hit the spot. Like at that exact moment, I don't think the brisket or the sliced turkey or whatever, I don't think that would have hit the spot. But the Club Melt, last time I encountered it, was exactly the right food at exactly the right time, and that's a feeling I would like to replicate in the future.
Okay, based on my limited experience at Buc-ee's, since I have zero, just people giving me stuff, I wouldn't go for the food. I go for the condiment, and that's the Scorpion hot sauce.
Boo?
The Scorpion. Somebody gave me the bottle of the Scorpion hot sauce. Yes. It was awesome. I put it on literally everything I had at home, and I ran out within a week or so.
Well, now I know what I'm getting you next time. Hey, let's drive out to Mississippi tonight. Just go to Buc-ee's.
Just go to Buc-ee's.
Happy New Year. We're going to Buc-ee's. Get in, loser. We're going to Buc-ee's. I went to the Buc-ee's in Sevierville, Tennessee, which is the second biggest Buc-ee's in the country. It used to be the biggest Buc-ee's, and then they built one in Texas.
It's not a measuring contest here, Ian.
Oh, all right. Well, I don't know. You know, my Buc-ee's is bigger than your Buc-ee's. We'll be back in just a minute. Get one more look at traffic with Courtney VIP, and then we'll hand it over to Sports Talk. Pelicans game is coming on at 5:30 on AM and FM. Stick around for that. I'll be back right after this. Don't go anywhere on WWL. Quick corrections corner here. I screwed up. I got something wrong.
What'd you do?
I always say, if I get something wrong, I want to know about it. I'm not afraid to be wrong. It's not Sevierville, Tennessee. It's Sevierville.
That's what the guy on the phone
Sevierville.
Said.
Sevierville. I mean, I looked it up. Yeah, there is some discussion about how you pronounce that, even among people who live in eastern Tennessee, but it seems like the consensus is it's Sevierville, like severe weather, Sevierville. Anyway, coming up on the show on Friday, I'll be back with you. Scoot will be back on Monday. I want to talk about why some viral branding works and why some doesn't, and how some brands get cool nicknames like Coke and others don't. So that's one thing we're going to start out with. I'm going to have another great show for you on Friday to start out 2026. So excited to start out this year with you. Please enjoy Sports Talk coming up for a hot 90 minutes. Here's the news. Thank you, Chris, Courtney, Coleman, Scoot, Diane, Dan. Love you. Happy New Year.